Hi, it's Paul Bannis with GreatDad.com, and I'm here with my weekly series talking to dads of all shapes and sizes about their experience with fatherhood. But today, a one-time exception, maybe more than one-time exception, but I've got somebody who's not quite yet a dad, about maybe someday very soon being a dad. But I've got Nick Hutchinson with me today to talk about reading, just in general, but reading for dads and how they can optimize their reading experience. So welcome, Nick.
Paul, I'm excited to be here. Can I ask you the first question today?
I've never had that. Sure, go ahead.
Well, I see all of the amazing books behind you, and sometimes my curiosity, it jumps out at me. What is the best book that you read in 2023? What comes to mind? I mean, we just wrapped up. We're headed into 2024 at the time of this recording. So I'm curious, what was the best book you read last year?
I think I read a lot of forgettable books, but probably the one that sticks in my mind the most right now, because my son is reading it too, is called Anomaly. It was a
Anomaly.
bestseller in France. It's about a plane that crashes, or no, a plane that, yeah, plane that, oh, the plane that lands, but a second plane identical to it lands like 6 months later. And it's a kind of a science fiction story, but it's really deep in its philosophical implications of two different selves meeting up. Just a page-turning thriller with a lot deeper meaning. So
Oh,
that's the
amazing. Well, thank you for satisfying my curiosity.
one. So we want to talk about a lot of different things here, but first maybe you have a book that you're coming out with, and you work with books and with authors all the time. But when you say the rise of the reader, do you mean the read that reading is coming back, or what do you mean by rise of the reader?
Sure. So from my perspective, Rise of the Reader, which is the title of my book, just launched on November 1st. It's changing reading from a form of entertainment to reading as a form of education. And I work in the personal development, sort of self-help, nonfiction business type industry. So that's a lot of what I'm reading, using these books to improve your life. But I want people to take more action from the books they're reading. Otherwise, if you read a great personal development book or a self-help book and you choose not to take action on it, then I say that's closer to a form of entertainment than it is actual education or behavior change. So I'm also somebody who just turned 30, so I'm a little bit younger. I've been running my business and my social media following for about 7 years now, and I do want reading to come back. I want it to be fun and sexy and professional, and I want people to talk about the books they're reading. And I definitely am trying to bring some more life energy back into the physical paper book.
Well, that's a great mission. I know that a lot of people who kind of call themselves the people of the book, are very dismayed by the fact that books seem to be on the wane, though still very strong among, one group of people. And they certainly have a lot of cultural impact looking back and looking forward. When the difference, I think, between novels and self-help books, do you feel like there are still things to be learned from novels that have an impact on the self-help book? I mean, I think that people used to say that novels are a way of understanding the human condition and the way other people think to get outside of yourself. But is there something else beyond that you see?
Yeah, I think there are a number of benefits to reading novels or works of fiction, science fiction, all types of fiction. So, number one is that from my perspective, fiction is the only place where the impossible becomes possible with the stroke of a pen or the typing of a keyboard. And that's so cool to me. I think that we can grow and expand our minds in different directions. I think creativity is a learned skill that can be improved and practiced and digested. And fiction is a great way to get that. And like we were kind of talking about before we pressed record, reading any type of physical paper book lengthens your attention span. It allows you to practice deep work, delay gratification a little bit. And that skill set of focusing on one task at a time is transferable to other areas of your life. And we live in this time where instant gratification is all we're optimizing for on social media and with television and everything in between. And so the idea of sitting down with a physical paper book of any type and focusing on it, I think that's a magical thing that is being lost, in some part in big areas of society, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, is getting away from those quick dopamine hits that you get off of TikTok or whatever. I mean, we all experience that, whatever the platform is. but trying to not do it quite as much, or trying to, you know, trying to move to some other things that are these longer term experiences is obviously better. They talk also about the fact that as you get older, a lot of people step away from fiction. I have a master's degree in French literature. I used to read all the time, all fiction, and stopped reading fiction, like a lot of people do in middle age. They move to nonfiction because it's more real. It's more things that they can, that is directly applicable. And perhaps it has a magic of its own because it's real, though sometimes it seems like fiction. But what the experts are telling us now is that for memory and development of being able to hold many different ideas at the same time, you should read fiction because it's the one literary form where you have to keep track of characters and where they are, and that makes the brain work in a different way. So I recommend going. I went back to fiction. I made a conscious effort, like 10 years, to go back to fiction, and I read 15 minutes to 30 minutes every day of fiction for that reason. And I'm loving it. I rediscovered it.
I'll admit that I have to focus a little bit more on fiction. If I read 100 books a year, 90 of them are probably in the nonfiction personal development space. One of my favorite genres is the parable genre or business fable type genre, where you're learning self-help style lessons through a fictional format. So you could take a spiritual book like Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is a fictional story, but you're learning about transcendence and you're learning about Eastern philosophy. And what's great about that format, it's kind of a blend of fiction and nonfiction, is that you're not being preached at, but you're still being preached to. You're just observing it in a third party perspective almost. You know, and that doesn't happen in nonfiction very much. I just read Tuesdays with Morrie recently. Have you read that book?
Yeah, I just had Rob Schwartz on the show a couple month or two ago. His son, Maury's son.
Oh, that's
Fascinating.
amazing. Yeah, and what's so great about a story like that is Morrie could have had written the book by himself, right? He could have preached at the audience. Here are all the things that I learned in my old age, but instead, you're learning as he's teaching somebody else, and it lowers your defense mechanism and it allows you to sort of absorb the information without putting up any defenses. So I think there's a benefit to all types of information and consumption. And I think, you know, you're sort of inspiring me already to add a little bit more fiction into my book
All
diet.
right, you'll join my book club, which I do not have, but I'll create one. So what you're in your day job, when you're not writing a book, you actually work with authors, mostly like you say, in the self-help category. And self-help always sounds kind of patronizing or minimizing, but obviously there are good self-help books and there are bad self-help books. And we talked a little bit about this before we started, and maybe you have some experience where you are helping people who write bad ones. But how does the average person parse out what seems to be highly rated self-help books that are really kind of garbage? You know, maybe they're super easy to read and fun to read, but they're not really helping you, versus the ones that are really, you know, would stand the test of time, that really are the core basic truths that using a self-help book can really advance that learning.
I have so many thoughts on this subject. So we could
We
spend
only
the
have
next
30
half an
minutes,
hour. I know. I actually have an entire chapter in my book, Rise of the Reader. It's chapter 4, and it's all about navigating the downsides of the self-help industry. And there are quite a few. One of them is bad actors. There are people out there purely to sell information and then upsell you into a course or coaching or consulting or things like that. Now, sometimes those people have great intentions and they are leveraging the medium of a book, maybe not to its purest form, but they're still out there trying to help people. I think the vast majority of authors in the space have nothing but great intentions. They're condensing decades of their lived experience into days of consumption, and they're making that lesson available for $20, and you can consume it in a few hours of your time. And that's a beautiful tool for improving your life. But there are some bad actors out there. And I think that one of the ways that we can start to become more aware of these people is simply by doing a little bit of research before we press buy on Amazon. I think Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, these are platforms where people share their honest opinions. And whenever I'm looking at the review section of a book on any of those platforms, I toss out the 5-star reviews. I toss out the
those are
one and
probably
two
paid.
star reviews. Yeah, because those are typically written by friends, or they're written from a place of emotion. I want to get to the logic. I think the 3 and 4-star reviews, that's where you find here's what I expected. Here's what was delivered. Here's what was missing. Or, hey, really good information, but the author won't stop selling me now that I signed up for his email list. Or like, you'll see that kind of information in the Amazon description. The other thing that I'll mention is, just like you said, the best books stand the test of time. I think the older the book is and the more ratings and reviews it has, the more value it's provided, because it's really hard to sell books. The only way that they stand the test of time is if they really provide great value, and that value leads to word of mouth. So books that were released 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, before Amazon existed and before all these algorithms could be paid for and sponsored, people bought and sold those books because they were great books. And right. So yeah, the farther you can go back, I think the better.
Yeah, I'm thinking like How to Win Friends and Influence People, Andrew Carnegie. I mean,
it's a great book.
You can read that
Dale
book.
Dale Carnegie, you
can read it and say, wow, this is a piece of fluff. But a lot of those lessons for interpersonal relationships still stand the test of time. I also wonder about the idea of the self-help book really being a shortcut to life learning, because that should be the biggest promise to me, is that I'm a lot older than you are. I have learned some things over that period of time. Why should you have to go through 30 years to learn something that I learned, you know, 15 years ago, and it is just an obvious truth, whereas it might be hard for you to you know, learn that on your own. But the question I have for you there is, how much of this stuff do we have to learn on our own? There must be a lot of self-help books that, yeah, they give you the answer, but you're not going to be able to appreciate that answer until you actually have kids, or you turn 40, or you turn 50. So getting the answer in advance won't help. And I don't know what the question is in there, but it's something that intrigues me, because that's always the promises of these courses and the self-help book, is that it's a shortcut.
Yes. I think two things come to mind. Number one is that, well, actually three things come to mind. Number one is that a lot of the foundational skills that you could learn through trial and error might take you a very long period of time if you go at it alone. And other people have already figured it out. They've provided the roadmap to basics like personal finance, financial literacy, the basic understanding of health and diet, of mindset, of starting a business. I mean, these things, you could go at it alone, or you could follow the roadmap that's already been laid out for you, avoid a lot of discomfort, bypass a lot of failure, save a lot of headaches, and you can shortcut. So that's kind of thought number one. Thought number two is that for more complex subjects, I do think that they come with age, they come through experience. But if you read a book in advance of dealing with a situation, it's kind of like having a tool in your tool belt. You might buy a hammer, you don't see a nail every day, but by the time you do see a nail, you can pull out the hammer and use it more efficiently than having seen the nail and not had the hammer in the first place. So I kind of have this metaphor of like a book belt instead of a tool belt. Sometimes you read in advance of dealing with a problem, and that enables you to overcome that problem when you face it with much more efficiency. So we're talking about parenting. You know, it's a big subject of your podcast. My wife and I are going to start trying this year. And I decided to buy one of the best-selling books, What to Expect Before You're Expecting.
Right.
Rather than going into the process blind and having to figure out everything in a reactionary kind of state, I'm reading the book right now and I'm proactively thinking about a lot of the things that I'm going to deal with. Now I know it's totally different, wild, and crazy for every single person that goes through it, but I do want to be the most prepared version of a dad, of a father that I can be, so that I can navigate it with a little bit more certainty, with a little bit more knowledge and understanding. And I guess just to kind of wrap up the thought, the third thing was a rearticulation of the second, which is that here I am 10 years into my journey, and there are things that I'm learning through experience today that, yeah, I read about them in books, but they didn't prepare me very well. So there's this whole spectrum of life and situations, and there's no perfect answer.
Well, I guess that's true for a lot of things in life. We're learning structures and paradigms and models that then we find we later on apply somewhere else. If you went to business school, you learned lots and lots of stuff that you probably recognized. You could put the model on top of things that you'd seen before, but you haven't yet used that model then in a way in your actual job. So you're just preparing for them. And I think that's a great example of preparing for parenthood in that way, of trying to get beyond the, you know, the gauzy vision of what it's going to be like and getting to some of the reality, so that when it hits you, you won't be quite as shocked.
Yeah. And I'll throw out one more example real quick, which is that You could read every sales book on the planet, but if you don't have any experience to tie what you're reading to,
sure.
You don't have any failed situations where you could say, oh, this might've worked better. Then without that context, without the foundation, they're meaningless. And so I think that the perfect sort of formula is reading a great personal development or self-help or business book, and then putting it into action as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to have both pieces for it to be meaningful.
Yeah, I think I like that idea, whether that's something that you do on your own, like a sales handbook where you are the next day using those principles, or I teach a course on positive intelligence. I don't know if you know that book by, there's mm-hmm. a book by Shehrzad Charmaine, and it takes you through everything that's in my course. And he himself, he's built this course and is very open, that's built on all these principles of positive psychology, neuroscience, what we know about cognitive behavior therapy. It's nothing new, but it's packaged in a way in the book. And then if you take my course, it reinforces everything that you would have learned by yourself and maybe never implemented, because it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that you have to do. Doing it is a huge part of the learning experience to actually, you know, incorporate it, integrate it into your life.
It is. Yeah. And that's the underlying message in my book, Rise of the Reader. It's without action, without implementation, nothing changes. I kind of have this funny thing where I say no books plus no implementation equals no change. Books plus no implementation still equals no change.
Yeah,
it's only books plus implementation that creates the behavior that you're looking to adopt.
Right. Okay. So concretely, what, like a dad who's maybe trying to find 15 minutes, what would you recommend they start with trying to, if they want to try to integrate more reading, fiction, nonfiction to their day, rather than scrolling or watching TV or any of the other options?
The first question that I typically ask somebody in this situation is a little goofy, but hear me out. I say, if I paid you $10,000 to read a physical paper book by the end of next month, do you think you could do it? And that same person who just told me they don't have time to read, they go, well, yeah, of course, I could read five, right? So it's not a question of whether or not we can read. It's a question of whether or not we value reading enough to prioritize it in our calendar. Right. So let's say that, okay, now we're at the understanding that everybody could read if they chose to. How do we implement it? Well, instead of trying to find time, what I recommend is replacing a low impact activity like scrolling on social media or binge watching Netflix with reading a great book. And in as little as 15 minutes in the morning and 15 minutes in the evening, that's 30 minutes, a beginner can read about 20 pages. 20 pages, 5 days a week, that's 100 pages a week. Most of these books are 200 or 300 pages these days, which means that you can get through a book every 2 or 3 weeks by replacing a little bit of social media in the morning and a little bit of Netflix in the evening. Not the whole thing. I'm not a robot. I'm just saying, serve your future self a little bit more than you are today, because I can't even remember the names and main, you know, the main characters in Netflix shows I watched 3 months ago, right? But these books, I can leverage them for the rest of my life. There's more leverage to reading something like that.
Yeah. And then how do you reconcile that with a lot of people whose their first thought is, oh, that's boring. Or if I talk about those books, everybody's going to think I'm some sort of weirdo, or I'm, you know, I'm overeducated. I'm putting on airs. I'm trying to be too pretentious. I guess I have a feeling about that where I'd rather be with people who read books, who have new ideas, who are exposed to new things, who have, you know, who are thinking up here rather than down here at the Netflix, you know, binge watching level. But how do you, I mean, you must encounter people like that who are worried about what reading might do to their persona.
I was one of them. So yeah, I definitely know what it feels like. I mean, I received all sorts of criticism from friends and family when I first started reading these books.
Wow.
You know, hey, it's all snake oil salespeople in that industry, or there's no real science. It's all just kind of, you know, woo spiritual stuff. And the fact of the, well, sort of for me, the proof was in the pudding. I was working, when I first started reading these books, it's because I was working a full-time tech sales job out of college. I was reading the world's best sales, marketing, communication, persuasion, and negotiation books, applying the frameworks to my sales position and making a ton of money as a result of it. I kind of say it like this. Imagine there's two salespeople. They start at the same time. They have the same exact skill set. They're brand new, but one decides to read the 12 best sales books of all time and apply them throughout the year. The other chooses not to. Who wins, right? of course, the one that's reading the books from the world's best salespeople wins. So I had to navigate that constructive, well, it wasn't even constructive, that negative feedback as I was first starting. Here's what I say to those people. Life doesn't have to be so hard. About 100 billion people have lived before us, and they've all experienced ups and downs and lefts and rights. Some of them figured out how to navigate this thing we call life pretty efficiently. Millions of those people have documented their greatest life lessons into a book that's available for $20 in a few hours of your time. And all of us have problems we're facing on a daily basis. And if we think they're unique to us, we're lying to ourselves because the solution is available. If you choose not to remove a problem from your life that's going to persist, let's say for the next 30 years, 365 times 30 is 11,000 almost. So if you choose not to deal with the problem, you're going to face that problem 11,000 more times over the next 30 years. Or you could suck it up, buy a $20 book, spend a few hours reading it, apply the solution to your life, and be stress-free. That's how I think about it. And so, yeah, sometimes we need to read about ego. I mean, Ryan Holiday wrote a great book, Ego is the Enemy. We just posted about it yesterday. And you can overcome some of these issues with your friend group and your family and some of the criticism and this personality of, I don't want to read a self-help book. I just want to watch Netflix. Like, I'm definitely trying to fight that narrative.
Yeah, well, that's good. I do think we are in a world right now where, at least in this domain, where there's a bifurcation, where you have the people who are more focused on the TikTok and on the Netflix, and nothing's wrong with that. I mean, entertainment is great. People need an escape, whatever that escape is, fishing or watching football or whatever it is. But there's another cohort or another part of people who are going to be successful in this world because they engage in trying to be better on a daily basis. Self-help books are one of them. I don't like that term because it
personal development. Yeah.
Personal development. Yeah. Or they're taking courses too. And I mean, you're not a course guy, but in that whole world, there's a whole bunch of snake salesmen versus people who are really doing good things too. But that world too is people are taking an active step to shortcut the learning process and implement the things that they're learning. And I think that we're going to see a real difference here in terms of how people think of continuing learning, which used to be something you did at the community college. Now anybody can do it in a short amount of time every day just from their computer. And it's a massive revolution.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, sometimes I joke around and I say that, yes, I'm 30 years old, but if you include the 500 books I read over the last 10 years that each condense decades of somebody else's lived experience into days of consumption, I'm thousands of years old. Or you could say, yes, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, a wonderful biography that details the beginning of Apple with Steve Wozniak all the way through Steve Jobs' death. You could say that book costs $20. What's its value? $20. Or you could say Apple is a $1 trillion company, and this book details every decision they made to build the company that exists today. Is it worth $1 trillion? You know, like, that's kind of how I think about bypassing. Once you get a good understanding of what they did, you can replicate their behavior. They leave breadcrumbs, a roadmap that you can follow. You can filter your decision-making through theirs. And that doesn't just apply to business. That applies to every area of health and fitness and nutrition and mindset and relationships and fatherhood and all of those types of things.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, good. One more thing before we go, because I think it's relevant to fathers and reading. You and I both shared stories about the challenges of getting young people to read. There's a book that's called How to Raise a Reader that makes it seem like you just follow these, 10 steps. It's magic. But you have a personal story about your dislike for reading and when that shifted. Why don't you tell a little bit about that to give hope to dads out there who are worried that their son or daughter hasn't quite gotten it yet.
Yeah, what might surprise anybody that can see my background, I have 1,000 books behind me, is that I was not much of a reader growing up. I was somebody who went through the U.S. public education system. And early in my experience, I developed a lot of anxiety around presenting in class. And we all have those moments where you're reading a book as a group in a class and everybody's in a circle and you go paragraph by paragraph. And I have memories of trying to avoid messing up or stuttering on a word, trying to avoid getting laughed at or made fun of, and literally getting up and leaving the classroom or staying home sick on presentation days because I just had so much insecurity around what other people thought of me. Mm-hmm. And it was only in the classes where you had to stand up and present or read in front of the class where I felt those insecurities. Classes like English, literature, history, foreign language. But I was always rock solid in the private test-taking classes like math, for instance. And again, it all stemmed from this idea of if you don't think the same way that the teacher does in a word report on a book, you'll be penalized for that. Or if you stand up in front of the class and you can't read very well, you'll be made fun of for that. I was not a very articulate kid. And so there started to form this gap. I started to separate from a lot of my classmates because of this insecurity. And so I think some of those things, they created a distrust of reading. I didn't like reading. I was being forced to read books I didn't want to read, and I was being forced to present on them, and that made me insecure. And so I stopped reading. I defaulted to the jock stereotype, the athlete, where I was playing football and I was wrestling and I was sort of making fun of the nerdy readers, right? And I regret all of that. I wish I found a way to navigate that more efficiently when I was younger. But, you know, so that's why it took me until the age of 20 really to start reading any type of books. I mean, I was using Spark Notes to avoid having to read any of these books and just faking everything back then, which is so weird to think about now that I read 100 books a year.
Well, it's good that change. There was some sort of shift. You said right about 20, where you realized that there was a value in that. Was that during college, or you started reading for fun, or something?
Yeah, I took a sales internship at a local software company going into my senior year of college. And my boss at the time, Kyle, I think he saw some unfulfilled potential in me, this young, kind of cocky 20-something year old kid who wouldn't read a book. And he actually said, "Hey, Nick, I see that you're commuting an hour each way, 5 days a week. So you're in the car for 10 hours a week." He said something that still sticks with me today. He said, "Listening to the same song or the same radio station for the 300th time, It's not going to get you closer to where you want to be in life, but the right podcast might." And so I actually started by listening to podcasts. And I was listening to shows where successful people were being interviewed. And what I recognized very quickly, because I was listening so much, was that so many of these successful people gave at least some credit for their success to the books that they were reading. So that's how I got into it. I realized that if I was deliberately choosing not to read these books, then I was also deliberately choosing to avoid the advice of the people who had done what I wanted to do. And that didn't make a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, well, that's I think that's what it takes for a lot of people, is to really understand that there is this link between success, and if you're after financial success or personal success, any type of thing, reading has got to be part of that, or some sort of ingestion of material. And for some people, that's books on tape or podcasts, like you say. I've talked to a lot of other reading experts on the show about this kind of like, it's a long-term project for a lot of kids. And it starts with modeling the behavior for your kids, reading to them when they're little, reading to them when they're babies, making sure that reading is part of the family relationship, the family values, and then hopefully avoiding what you experience in public school, which I can imagine. I remember some of those reading circles where you had to go around, and if you tripped up, hopefully the teacher didn't laugh at you, but didn't feel good to do that in front of other people. But for dads out there, I think there's a far better chance that awakening is going to come maybe a little bit later than you want it to be. You know, maybe it won't come at 12 where they're reading all the time, but at 20 when something clicks and all that stuff is together. I know in our household, my son he was a good reader, but he didn't love to read. And then suddenly in the last year, he looks around our house and sees all the books, and he's just immensely proud of all the books we have that he can pull off the shelf. And he's found all kinds of friends who are readers too. And then, you know, 5 years ago, I would have been worried that he was ever going to become a reader. So, you know, have patience, model the right behavior, present it in the right fashion, and there is hope.
Yeah, I heard an entrepreneur, Ed Milet, say from stage recently that behaviors are caught, not taught in the household. So I'm sure that idea is replicated in the book, How to Raise a Reader, which I'll have to pick up. And I think that's true. I think that if you can demonstrate the value of reading and incorporate reading and as part of your family core values, and your kids see you with a book instead of just swiping all day long, they might go through a rebellious phase, as every teenager probably does, right? In their mid-teens and late teens. But then as they get hit with, okay, this is the real world. Now I'm in college or I'm out of college, and you've cemented that the importance of that behavior in them, they'll probably come back to it. I've seen that happen with a lot of my friends and family, and I think it's more natural to happen that way.
Yeah, maybe there should be more concentration. I know they always, when you're in school, starting in like a middle school or whatever, they start talking about the difference of potential earnings, whether you go to college or not. But maybe there should be a little bit more discussion of, how much time you invest in self-development and reading so that kids know that there is a real true linkage between how good a reader you are and how much you've read, how much you've ingested of other, other thoughts to shortcut things that would really help. It would be beneficial because I think a lot of kids miss out on the reason for reading, that it isn't just for an experience like TikTok. It has nothing to do with the experience of TikTok, but
What are your thoughts on paying or incentivizing children to read books on subjects like personal finance or mental health or anxiety, like things like that?
yeah, well, great question. I have not incentivized my kids. I incentivized them to read the classics because I found that they weren't reading as many books that maybe selfishly I read when I was in middle school and high school that I thought that were true classics and that they should have read by the time they got to high school. So we did it, and we incentivized both kids, same amount of money. My daughter read all the books, made all the money, ka-ching. My son did, I barely looked at the list, like, I'm not doing that. So the thing is about the incentivization is it usually works for the kid who's already the reader. So if you have a list of finance books or whatever, and it ties into the child's already his or her interest, I think it works really well. But it isn't a substitute for it. It's almost like forcing them, or it's not going to work if it's not something that they're already interested in. So I think that's what I learned in my experience of, a sample set of two. But there is a
Yeah,
lot
I don't know
made about
much
that, and I
about
think a
it.
lot of people say no.
I remember reading about Dr. Ben Carson, neurosurgeon, and then got involved in politics for a little while. But he grew up in a one-parent household where his mom couldn't read. And I remember reading that she would send him to the local public library every weekend, and he would have to read a book and write a report on it. And she couldn't even read the report, but that was sort of a mandatory thing before he could go out and play or have freedom on the weekends and stuff like that. And listen, like we've talked about, I'm not a parent yet, but I definitely want to collect feedback on what works. So that's
Yeah,
why I
see,
was curious.
it's a double-edged sword. I love that idea. That's a, kind of like the hard parenting idea. Like, you got to read a book before you can play. But then it makes it sound like you got to eat your spinach before you can have the pie. And whoever learned to love spinach because they got the pie is the, it just it doesn't work that way. So,
Right. It's the same issue I had in high school, right? You're forced to read a book you don't want to read. So now I don't want to read at all.
Ben Carson he did okay as a neurosurgeon, but maybe he doesn't even like what he does because it was jammed down his throat. Immensely successful, but unhappy. I don't know. Well, this has really been a fun and different conversation for me, Nick. Thank you very much for joining. The book is Rise of the Reader, and then people can find what you do at bookthinkers.com, which is a service that helps authors get their book done and learn how to market it in a more modern and viral way.
Yeah,
What do you
just the second half. So just promotion and marketing, positioning, branding, things like that. But we're not involved in the writing of the books just yet. Maybe soon, though. We'll see.
Okay. Well, great. Nick, thank you for joining us. As I mentioned, I do a course on positive intelligence, which I'll pitch for once. I usually don't pitch that, but greatdad.com/PQ. You can find information on that. And then my course on gratitude, which I think is immensely helpful for finding happiness, is at greatdad.com/gratitude. And listeners of the podcast can get 50% off that course by putting in podcast 50. Okay,
I
Nick,
love
thank
it.
you much for joining us. Remember, as always, stay close to your kids, watch what they're doing, ask them great questions. The most important thing about being a dad is just being there as a dad. Thanks.
Love it, Paul.